Philip Plait up next. The Bad Astronomer, get ready on Coast to Coast AM. Philip Plait, he's a professional astronomer. He's an author. Until recently, he worked at Sedona State University in California, developing educational material based on space science. Before that, he spent 10 years working on Hubble Space Telescope data, studying everything from asteroids and red dwarf stars to distant quasars and supermassive black holes. However, in 2007, he left that job to become a full-time author. His next book, Death from the Skies, deals with all the ways astronomical events can wipe us all out. Here's our special guest tonight on Coast to Coast, Philip Plait. Hey, Philip, how are you?
Hey, George, I am doing fine, and it is wonderful to talk to you again. It's been a little while.
You know, it's been over, in terms of a full show, it's been almost a year. It's been over a year.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I've been on a few times. I was just looking over because I'd actually forgotten a couple of the times, I'm embarrassed to admit.
Well, no, you've had little sprinkles here and there.
Exactly, talking about Pluto not being a planet and things like that. And suddenly, as soon as I read that, it's like, oh, yeah, that was fun. I like talking about that stuff.
Well, you know, you're a staple of the program, Philip. People love you, and I want you to explain to the world why you call yourself the Bad Astronomer.
Well, I suppose we should cover that again since it's been a while.
Well, and we have thousands of new people popping up all the time.
10 million listeners, is that right?
Well, it depends on what day, I think.
Well, I hope they're listening now.
I've got one guy back at the studio who counts them one at a time.
Wow, I hope he has a lot of fingers and toes.
Yeah, really.
Well, I started my website back in 1993 when the web was just a little fetus. And I started writing about astronomical myths and misconceptions. I started with this legend, which is actually kind of going away, that you can stand eggs on end only on the vernal equinox, on the first day of spring. And that's nonsense. You can stand eggs on end any time. But I wrote about that and thought, this is kind of fun. I can write about other astronomical misconceptions. And eventually I got the domain name badastronomy.com and just as a joke started calling myself the Bad Astronomer, but it kind of stuck. And that's what people call me now, and most people get it. It also gives people who don't like me a chance to make fun of my name. That's okay. And it's something easy to remember, and I've had that domain name since 1998, so next year will be my 10th anniversary. I can hardly believe it.
Philip, how did you get involved in astronomy as a kid?
Oh, yeah. If any of the listeners out there, let me tell you, I have talked to astronomers, astronauts, scientists, everybody who has a lifelong love of astronomy. They all have roughly the same story, and that is that when they were a kid, their parents took them to a museum, to a planetarium, bought them a telescope. In my case, my dad brought home a dinky little garbage department store telescope, set it up at the end of the driveway, and pointed it towards Saturn. And I looked at Saturn through that telescope. And even now, I show people Saturn through my telescope, and they can't believe it. It looks just like it does in the pictures. Now, not as much detail, but you see this perfect little circle with the rings around it.
Oh, it was gorgeous, wasn't it?
It is so beautiful. And I was hooked. I mean, it was just that simple. I knew right then. I was 5 years old, I think. I can't remember that far back. I might have been four, but I think I was five. And I tell you, I read these stories over and over again, people who look through a telescope, and that's that.
My very first telescope was just, you know, a refractor type. You know, not a lot of power, but my parents bought it from an astronomy shop. And this old guy, he had lectures and stuff that he would do every week in his shop. Kids would be there. And he had the place, Philip, painted, you know, with the moon and Saturn and, you know, pictures all over the place. And it was a dark place. And then he sold his telescope. So my very first telescope, it was a white telescope. And the tripod was wood. And he had it spray painted black. And then he had little dots all over the place, thousands of little dots that he somehow, I guess, spray painted from a distance or something, you know, just shot them. And I got to tell you, you know, it was the greatest feeling for a kid. You know, growing up in Detroit, I would go outside in the middle of the night, frigid cold out, you know, 10 degrees above zero, and I would look at things And it was the greatest feeling in the world for a kid to be outside alone with his telescope on a starlit night, freezing, and then going in for hot chocolate and coming back again. And I, too, was hooked right after that.
I think the hot chocolate might be the best part. Yeah, it's really a great hobby. I started out as a hobbyist, as an amateur astronomer for years, although I was pretty sure I wanted to do this as a profession, even when I was a kid. But you know, you can buy a small telescope. They're not that expensive. I wouldn't recommend buying a really cheap telescope because they can be very difficult to use. The mount can be wobbly and the optics might not be very good. And you can actually do the opposite of what you want to do. You might actually discourage kids from using them because it can be tough. But if you get a good telescope, and actually I should back up a little bit and say binoculars are really good. I have three pair of binoculars, actually. I use them all the time. As a matter of fact, it's snowing here. I'm in Boulder, Colorado, and we've got, I don't know, 6-7 inches of snow on the ground. And last week, a great horned owl landed in a tree right over my fence with my neighbor's house. And so I had the binoculars out looking at that. And today, there was a hawk in my backyard. And the binoculars are really useful for that. But also just at night, scanning the skies, it's so easy to use binoculars. But you can start that way. Then you can get a telescope. I had a cheap telescope. I was constantly fixing it up. Bought a bigger one eventually when I was a teenager. Went to college, got my degree, and then used Hubble. So you never know where this is going to lead.
It is a small world, isn't it?
But it's a big universe, and there's a lot to see.
Exactly. You've got what you call your top 10 astronomy pictures of 2007. We've got links up on the coasttocoastam.com website. Tell me about this.
Yeah, that was last year. I was just fooling around. It was around Christmas time, and I was thinking, yeah, you know, there have been a lot of good pictures this year. I should probably do something about that, talk about the ones I like the best. And I just decided to go through the pictures, and oh my, there were so many. Astronomy Picture of the Day, biggest astronomy website there is, and they run a different astronomy picture every day. I'm sure most of your listeners already know about it. You just look up APOD, APOD on the web. You'll find it. You know, there's 365, 366 in a leap year. Pictures right there. Then there are the pictures I've talked about on my blog. And then you have to go to the Cassini website, this orbiter that's around Saturn. It's been orbiting Saturn for several years now. The Mars orbiters. Now we've got probes orbiting the moon, and we're just getting picture after picture after picture. And that's not even including the amateur astronomer pictures. And so I looked through this year well over 1,000 pictures. It took a long time. And I found the ones that I liked. And Astronomy Picture of the Day picked theirs. There are a couple of others out there as well. You can find them. And, you know, astronomy pictures are beautiful. There's no doubt that a big picture of a spiral galaxy or a nebula or even a comet or a planet is just beautiful. And I picked mine not just for their beauty necessarily, but also for something about them. The picture might not have been as pretty, but it was something unexpected. One of my favorite pictures, although it's not that pretty, was my number 8 picture, which is from an ultraviolet satellite, a satellite that can detect ultraviolet light. And it looked at this star called Myra. Myra is a bright star. It's visible to the naked eye. It's easily visible. It's been known for centuries to change its brightness. It's a red giant. It's a dying star. And it's pulsating. It's in its last legs, basically. It's a dying star. And this has been known for a long time. But what wasn't known until they pointed this telescope at it, and it was actually just an accident, I think they just happened to catch it, is that the gas that this star is giving off as it's dying is leaving this long tail behind it as the star is moving through the galaxy. So it almost looks like a comet. You look at the picture of this thing, and it looks just like a comet. You've got this fuzzy ball at one end and this long tail. But the tail is 13 light years long. That's 80 trillion miles as this star has been moving. And it's taken 30,000 years for that star to do this. So the tip of this tail was emitted 30,000 years ago. And it's just an amazing picture that you're seeing this sweep of history. And the thing that kills me about it, as soon as I saw it, I thought, this is going to be huge. And it was. When they did the press release, it was all over the news. It's because it's a bright star. We've been observing this thing for years, and yet it wasn't known that it had this thing trailing off of it. And it's only when you open your eyes to a different part of the electromagnetic spectrum, ultraviolet light, infrared, or you build a new detector or a bigger telescope, or you do things in a different way, that you can discover something amazing about something you thought you knew really well. And I love stuff like that.
Tell me about the career change now for you.
that was a surprise. I was working at Sonoma State University, which is a teaching college in California. And we had grants through NASA and actually the Department of Energy, of all people, to develop educational activities for kids, mostly, right, and some college students. And I'd been doing that for 6.5 years, something like that. And that was a good job. That was a lot of fun. I got to work on our website. I got to give talks. I got to teach teachers how to use these materials. And it was wonderful because for every teacher, you can show how to teach about astronomy. That's hundreds and hundreds of students that you're reaching right there. So it was a fantastic job. But I've been trying to write a second book. My first book, which is just called Bad Astronomy, that came out in 2001, I think, and it's been a long time.
It has been a long time.
Well, I had all these ideas. It wasn't going anywhere. And then all of a sudden, Viking Press said, yes, we want to publish your book, but we need it by October. And I thought, that's a few months. There's no way I can work full time and write a book. And I really, really want to write more. I've got more book ideas. I've got other things I want to do. And I, you know, sat down with my wife and we talked about it. And I made a tough decision. I decided to quit a salaried position.
That's scary, isn't it, when you first do
you
that?
You think?
Yeah, you think.
I've got a daughter, and she's a preteen. She's going to be going to college in a few years. But, you know, we decided that this is my calling, I suppose. I love to write, you know, and if I can go out there and maybe give lectures, give public talks and stuff and get paid for that, I might be able to recoup some of the lost salary. But in the meantime, you know, I've got the itch. I had to write this book.
Does this mean every time you write a book, I got to get you back on the program?
At least, come on.
All right,
I can only
all right.
crank them out every couple of years.
Okay.
I hope it's not six years for the next one.
And it is tough. I've got a partner in a series of books that we've written or will be coming out, Bill Burns. And there's no way, Philip, I could have done it without this partner at all. And, you know, so many radio people and, you know, other celebrities and well-known television people, when they write books, a lot of times it's a ghostwriter.
Yeah, you gotta wonder sometimes.
They don't do much. Well, you know, Bill did a lot of the work on this book. I wrote a lot of chapters, and he cleaned it up. I mean, he was like my own personal editor, and I told him at the beginning. I says, no, Bill. You know, regardless of my contribution, you are an equal partner on Worker in the Light, and you know, and he's been just a gem. But there's no way, Philip, doing this program, conducting my own private life, I could have done this book by myself. There's no way.
Sure, I know that feeling precisely. My first book, which was mostly about, myths and misconceptions, these were topics I was pretty familiar with. And so the amount of research I had to do was, you know, it was a lot. It was substantial, but it wasn't overwhelming. But for this book I just wrote, Death from the Skies, each chapter deals with a different aspect of some danger from space, like asteroid impacts, solar flares, exploding stars. And even for something like exploding stars, supernovae, and their sister phenomenon called gamma ray bursts, which we can talk about.
We're going to hit them all tonight. I mean, all these subjects that you bring up are dear to my heart, and they're all really life-threatening.
Yes, although the chances of them happening are very remote, which is something I stress highly in the book. I don't want to scare people, except in the aspect of like watching a scary movie or going on a roller coaster. You're terrified while you're on it, and then it's over and it's done. And I kind of want to have people being excited while they're reading about gamma ray bursts because they're really, really scary. But the odds of one hitting the Earth are essentially zero. But, you know, I studied these things for years. When I was at Sonoma State, one of our grants was through a satellite that observes gamma ray bursts. And so I went to meetings. I did a lot of writing about them. I did a lot of reading about them. But when it came to actually describing the heart of the phenomenon, I realized I couldn't do it without help. I needed to call experts and interview them and talk to them. And so, you know, this book was certainly written by me, but there's 100 other brains behind it. And it was really gratifying, especially in the sun chapter, because I really don't know that much about the sun walking into this. Now I do, for sure. And I talked to so many friends who are solar astronomers and learned so much about the sun and realized how complicated the sun is. It's ferociously complex, and there's so much we still don't understand about it, even though it is the brightest and easiest object in the sky to study, and it's the nearest star. And it's amazing what we don't know about it and some of the things that we do know.
If you were able to continue into the sun, okay, obviously without getting burned up, what would you find in it? I mean, is it nothing but a mass of gases, or is there some kind of solid little core in there somewhere?
Well, you can kind of divide the sun up into several layers, and it has an atmosphere, sort of. It's emitting a wind of gas, and there's this corona.
Can you use a different phrase?
Yes, if you can break through that wind. I know. They're actually...
Now I know why you're the bad astronomer.
Let me tell you, writing a book, especially with my sort of twisted sense of humor, there were so many dirty or scatological jokes I had to, like, pull myself back from making. And I thought, you know, if I'm ever lecturing to kids in an elementary school, I can make poopy jokes, but maybe not in a hardcover book. But, well, so as you're approaching the sun, you're going through this, the corona, this super hot, very tenuous, thin gas surrounding it. And then there's the surface of the sun, but it's not like the surface of the Earth. You're not going from air to a solid or air to a liquid. The sun just gets gradually more dense until you're going through extremely thick gas. And the densities change as you go down. There are different layers that do different things. But the heart of the sun is its core. And that's where hydrogen is fusing into helium like a hydrogen bomb. You combine hydrogen nuclei, and they form helium nuclei, and they release energy. And that's basically how a hydrogen bomb works. But the sun is converting, and I love this. You got to be sitting down for this. It's converting 700 million tons of hydrogen into helium every single second.
Oh, my gosh.
And I figured this out one day. That is equal to 7 fully loaded oil tankers. If you have ever seen an
every
oil tanker.
Every second. Boom.
Yeah.
Boom.
If you've ever seen an oil tanker, they are huge. And you can think 7 of these full of hydrogen. You know, their weight converted into helium every second. And so what's happening is that the sun, by doing that, is releasing a vast amount of energy. And that works its way out from the core into the outer layers and then is emitted as light from the surface. And that's what keeps us alive.
You know, we're going to take this little break and come back. I want to talk with you about the Mayan calendar because I believe it could be some kind of solar celestial event. And I want to get your take on that and all these other issues. Do you travel much anymore?
A little bit. Not as much as I used to, but I'm still traveling, and I'd love to do it even more.
Well, you're going to have to go on a book tour, you know.
Well, I'm hoping. The book will be out in the fall, and, you know, we haven't actually gotten that far yet. I've got the edited manuscript sitting on my desk. I have to work on it, but once it's all set, you know, I'm hoping to travel the country and plug it.
Great. All right, we'll stick around with our special guest tonight, Philip Plait. Yes, yes, we will open up the phone lines. Those of you who are calling now, just hold off on a little bit. We've got lots to talk with him about on Coast to Coast AM. Yeah, I'm going to start a one-week vacation starting tomorrow. We've got a number of hosts. I'll tell you about that at the end of the program tonight who are going to be filling in for me. None other than Art Bell will be taking 1, 2, 3 programs for us. So I'm looking forward to that. Maybe actually 4, I think. So a week of art, which is fantastic. But I want to just thank all of you as we get into the new year for continuing to make Coast to Coast the most successful late night program in history. Thank you so much. Those of you, of course, who listen on your favorite radio stations across North America, Streamlink members, of course, XM Satellite, and then the various supportive chat rooms. My dear friends at thenighthawkzone.com, thank you for just what you've been doing. I mean, you've been extremely personable. You've been kind. You've been informative. And more importantly, you've been a friend. So thank you. Imaginative Worlds, the Sorcery IRC, Into Infinity, Fantastic Form Group, National Radio Club, Frog Forum. Just the list goes on and on and on. The MySpace chat rooms. And just thanks for making Coast to Coast what it is today. Hey, Philip, before we get into all these other incredible areas here, Mayan calendar, 2012, celestial event, I think, solar burst from the sun. What do you think?
Well, this is going to be one of those things where you and I probably part ways a little bit.
Well, hey, you know, but we're still friends.
That's true, and that's one of the things. I like talking to you. It's fun, and I like covering some of these topics that are sort of out on the edge.
Yes.
Because sometimes, you know, you never know where it's going to lead. Some of these wacky ideas like dark energy and dark matter turn out to be right. So it's always good to talk about stuff. And the Mayan calendar is certainly, the 2012 stuff is certainly something that a lot of people are interested in. I see a lot of people searching my website for it. And in fact, I haven't written anything about it yet because I've been too busy with the book. And it's a plan of mine to actually write up a big thing about it, in fact.
You've got 4 years. Don't worry about it.
That's true. The deal is, as I'm sure you've talked about on the show many times, the Mayan calendar ran on cycles. They had different cycles of years. And in 2012, and it's been calculated as, I think, December of 2012, the calendar runs out, that the cycles all turn over. And this has been, a lot of people are talking about this. And I was actually doing some research, and at the same time I was researching this years ago, somebody posted on my discussion board, which has now actually been merged with the Universe Today discussion board, universetoday.com.
Okay.
It's now called Bout, B-A-U-T, so it's boutforum.com. I have links on my website to this, and you can talk about this. But somebody had actually researched this and said, look, the Mayan calendar is like cycles on your odometer of your car. And as you're driving, you can see the tenth miles going, or tenth kilometers, I suppose, since this is all over the world. And then you can see the miles tick over, and once you go 10 miles, the tens place clicks over. And the Mayan calendar was like this. It had these different units. And in December of 2012, the biggest cycle is going to turn over. But it turns out that's just the biggest cycle so far. It'll turn over to the next cycle. So all the current cycles reset to zero, and the next biggest one clicks over to one. So it's not like the calendar ends, which is what a lot of people are claiming. The calendar doesn't end. It's just turning over, kind of like the way we went from 1999 to 2000. So,
well, we'll see what happens. We get hit with the blast around December 21st, 2012. I'll be the first to say I told you so.
Well, let me say that some people are saying that the sun aligns with the galactic center at that point as well. But that happens every December. The way the Earth goes around the sun appears to move in the sky and make a big circle in the sky through the zodiac constellation. And in December, it's in Sagittarius, and that is the direction towards the center of the Milky Way galaxy. This happens every year, and I looked at some software, and I didn't really see where 2012 puts the sun any closer to the galactic center than it does any other year. So I'm not putting a lot of faith on that either. Now, having said that, 4 years from now, the solar cycle goes up and down. It has a lot of activity and then no activity in a cycle of every 11 years. And so right now we're at the bottom of the cycle and we're ramping up towards the top again. And that'll be in about 5 years. So in, 2012 or so, 2013, the sun will be at the peak of its cycle. But I'll add that the most activity that we see from the sun, solar flares, these things called coronal mass ejections, these events that the sun has, these blasts that can affect the Earth, typically don't happen until about a year after the peak. So we probably won't be seeing a lot of this stuff until 2013, 2014. I'm not saying we can take that to the bank. I'm just saying that's what usually happens.
We've been lucky, Philip, that we haven't been hit directly with one of these X-flare coronal mass ejections, because, the sun has popped a few of those out over the last year or so, and, you know, it's kind of missed us or it's grazed us. But if there was a direct impact here, we could have some problems, couldn't we?
Oh, yeah. The sun has been very quiet for the past few years, which is typical when it's at the bottom of its cycle, like right now. But in 2003, I think it was October of 2003, I'd have to look that up, but I think that's the correct date. It just went nuts and was blasting off flare after flare, and they were not interacting with the Earth so strongly that we were getting a lot of problems with it, but there were satellites that were damaged, and there were all sorts of issues like that. Back in 1989, in March, in the dead of winter, basically, Quebec actually got a brownout. There were a transformer, I think, was totally destroyed, which started a cascade effect, and Quebec lost power because of one of these events. It really screws up the magnetic field of the Earth, and when you change a magnetic field, you create current, you create electric current. And so in the North American grid, the power grid, a huge amount of extra electricity was dumped into the power lines, and that heats them up, and it can blow transformers. There's all kinds of problems that can happen with that. And the really funny thing about this is chapter two of my book, I'll add, along with asteroid impacts, these are the only two astronomical events that can mess up life on Earth that are basically totally preventable. We can actually push asteroids out of the way so they don't hit us. Not that easy, of course. I mean, if they're small, they're hard to find.
And if we have time to do it, right? We have to have some time, a little leeway. Yeah.
And sometimes it doesn't take that much time. We have the technology to do it. We just need to test it. So we can actually prevent asteroid impacts. We can talk more about that later. But to stay on topic, we cannot prevent the sun from doing what it's doing. It's the 800-pound gorilla. It's a huge object. It's going to do what it's going to do. But if we built our power grids and our systems better to be able to handle this kind of load better, then this kind of thing wouldn't happen. We'll still lose satellites. It's very difficult to build satellites to resist the sort of load that they get when a solar flare hits them. It's an onslaught of subatomic particles that really wreaks havoc on electronics. And it's hard to prevent that. The military has satellites that can do it, but it's very expensive. But it is possible, and it is certainly possible to gird up our loins here on Earth and prevent it from happening. It just costs billions and billions of dollars, and, you know, that's a lot of money. On the other hand, you know, if a big coronal mass ejection, one of these giant blasts of hot gas from the sun, were to wipe out the North American power grid in the middle of winter, we could lose hundreds of lives, and it could cost billions of dollars.
Because it would take a long time to rewire and fix, wouldn't it?
Well, I think in general the Quebec power outage was fixed relatively rapidly, but that was because
they had a more sophisticated grid system, I think, than we've got. We've got an old one.
It is old, but there are spare parts. If you blow a transformer or another part which is important, they were able to find one rapidly and get it shipped there, and they got it installed. But these kind of things cost millions of dollars. And, you know, in the meantime, you've got people sitting without heat. My in-laws are from Kansas. They're visiting here for Christmas. We're having a great time. We're snowed in, ironically. But they
came from Kansas. That's kind of neat sometimes, though.
It was beautiful today with the snow. But the week before, just last week, they were sitting in Kansas without power for days and days and days. That's unacceptable in America to me. There are other countries that are not as modernized as we are, but they're smart enough to bury their power lines.
Well, I was going to say,
with ice, yeah. It doesn't fall on it. You know,
here in St. Louis, they are now starting. You know, of course, they've been doing it, but there's still a lot of power lines above ground. But they're going underground now. It's really the smartest thing to do.
And that's good for local, you know, so your house doesn't have power. On the other hand, these you know, high-capacity lines, there's a bunch of them just a mile away from me, and they're 100 feet off the ground. You know, an icy tree is not going to dump them. But if a big magnetic event from the sun were to couple with the Earth's magnetic field, it can induce a lot of current in these wires, and they heat up and sag, and they can snap. And that's a real danger.
In grade school, teacher said once that the sun would burn out in several billion years. And I got to tell you, I went home and I was so depressed. And my mother comes up to me and goes, Georgie, what's wrong? And I said, Mom, the sun's going to burn out in a few billion years. There'll be nothing. And I got to tell you, I don't know why it bothered me. I'm not going to be around. Why does that seem so depressing?
Well, the sun is a constant in our lives, unless you're in Seattle. But you know, it's one of these things where the sun rises, sun sets. We set our clocks by it. We owe our life to it. It doesn't seem to change, except when you look at it through a telescope and you see sunspots, like we will actually here in a year or two, and the sunspot cycle starts up again. But you know, when you're outside, you don't notice any difference, and it just seems like it's going to last forever. But in fact, it won't. Like a human or any other kind of form of life on Earth, it was born, it will live a certain amount of time, and then it will die. Actually, I wrote about this, and I thought I understood how the sun's going to die, and it turns out it was more complicated than I thought. But even then, it's going to go through a series of stages that will that any one of which could scorch and wipe out the Earth. It will expand into a red giant. Most people know about this. The sun, as it loses hydrogen in its core, the core will actually heat up. That sounds like a paradox, but as the hydrogen runs out, the core will shrink. And when you compress a gas, it gets hotter. It's the same reason your bicycle pump gets hot when you pump up a bicycle tire. You're compressing the gas and it heats up. And it's similar to this. And the sun will heat up. And when you dump all that extra heat into the outer part of the sun, when you heat up a gas, it expands. So the sun will expand, and it will start to occupy a much larger part of the Earth's sky. It'll scorch the Earth. But in the meantime, I love this. This kind of stuff is so cool.
It is.
In the meantime, the sun's solar wind will actually increase, and the sun will lose mass. So as the sun is getting hotter and expanding, it's losing mass as well. So its gravity will decrease, and the Earth will actually move away from the sun. So Mercury will certainly get swallowed up as the sun expands. Venus probably will, but the Earth is going to escape this fate because it'll move far enough away from the sun that it won't get swallowed. And you still see a lot of people saying, well, the sun's going to expand and eat the Earth. It almost certainly won't. But it also almost certainly won't really matter, because it's like the Earth will have been sitting in an oven for millions of years. And so we're going to get cooked and good. So by the time the sun actually dies, the Earth will have been totally, totally wiped out as far as we're concerned.
And there's no need going to Mars, because that's going to get hit too.
Mm-hmm.
Everything in the solar system.
Even Jupiter looks like that the sun will be so hot a little bit later in its life cycle that even the moons of Jupiter, like Europa, which has got this cap of ice on it, and it's probably got an underground ocean. It may have life for all we know. We don't know. Even that'll be vaporized by the heat from the sun, and you'd have to go out past Saturn to actually have temperatures that are cool enough to have life exist. It's actually an astonishing future for the sun. And
Philip,
all we know, you know, maybe we can move the Earth that far out. We're talking billions of years from now. Who can imagine what our technology will be?
Let's tow it, right?
Yeah, exactly. And there are ways to do that.
Come on.
No, it's really true. There's an astronomer named Fred Adams. This guy's a trip. He's one of these incredibly smart guys who is also extremely clever. I have several friends like this, and every time I talk to them, I walk away thinking I'm a little bit smarter now. And he's one of these guys. And he and a coworker, Greg Laughlin, and some other folks worked out that if you take a small asteroid about a mile across, and there is no end to these in the solar system, there are zillions of them out there, you can actually put rockets on it, push it towards the Earth, and let it whip by the Earth. And the gravity of that rock, at 1 mile across, is enough to tug the Earth a little bit, just a little bit. And if you do it just right, you can expand the Earth's orbit a little bit. So you have to do this over and over again. I think he said every 6,000 years for like the next billion years. But it'll actually move the Earth farther out from the sun. And, you know, if you're taking the long view, this might be a way to do it. Pretty amazing.
How weird, Phil.
He wrote a paper about this. I read it, and I thought, he's right. His math works out.
Hey, on your website, badastronomy.com. Do you talk much about extraterrestrial life or the possibilities? Do you get into that?
The site comes in two different sort of sections. I have the main page, which is a blog now, and I update that several times a day. On the main site, where I have what I call my static pages, the pages that don't change much, I talk about aliens a little bit there. And I wrote about it, I've written about it for magazines and such, and I get asked this question a lot, especially when I give talks. And they say, do you think there's life out in space, and do you think it's visiting us? And I say, yes and no. I do think there's life in space. I don't have any evidence for it, but there's statistics. We have discovered 200-plus stars that have planets, or I should say 200 planets around other stars. Some of these stars have multiple planetary systems now that we've discovered. And we're getting better and better at it, and it's just a matter of time before we find another Earth orbiting some other star. And when you look at the numbers, we've only examined stars that are relatively close by in a galaxy that is huge. And so the odds are really good that there are millions of Earth-like planets out there. And it seems fantastic beyond belief that life has not arisen on some of these other planets. It looks like life is almost inevitable. Life formed on Earth right after it cooled enough, and the bombardment of asteroids from outer space basically stopped. Life popped up.
Which may have been the seeds, don't you think,
that's
comets?
That's possible. That's called panspermia, the idea that life here started out there, as the old Battlestar Galactica opening used to say. And that's possible. I haven't seen any evidence for it. It's a really cool idea that is worth investigating. But we don't know enough yet about how this sort of stuff works to know whether life started. You know, we found amino acids, the building blocks of proteins in life. We found amino acids on asteroids, on meteorites. So that certainly could have formed out there and fallen to Earth. Life could have started on Mars and been brought here by asteroid impacts. We don't know. That's, again, another chapter in my book, because it's an interesting idea that life here may have started out in space. And we just don't know enough, I think, to be able to say one way or another. But, you know, look, a billion years after the Earth formed, we had life. And it took a long time for it to turn into us. But still, the universe is old and there are a lot of planets. And so I suspect that when we really start looking for the signs of life, oxygen atmospheres, for example, around other stars, around other planets, around other stars, we may find it. Whether they're visiting here, I don't see any evidence for it. I know a lot of people see flying saucers. They see, UFOs, I should say, and
see
the abduction
things.
Claims, and there are a lot of things like this, the Phoenix Lights and all this kind of stuff. But none of it, to me, as a scientist, and as Carl Sagan said, and as many scientists have said, the more you want to believe something, the more you have to be skeptical about it. Because if you want to believe it, you might be willing to overlook stuff that should have tripped your alarms. And so I would love to see a flying saucer land on the White House lawn. Oh, man, would I like to see Clack 2 and Gort walk out of their flying saucer.
You got it. Hey, Philip, we'll be back with you in a moment. We're going to talk about the possibility of asteroid impact, and also January 30th, Mars could get hit by an asteroid. We'll be back.